Welcome to Canucks Talk this afternoon, a special late and truncated one-hour edition of the program. I'm your host, Thomas Drance, flying solo for the hour. We've got a great show for you nonetheless. I'll be joined by Brendan Batchelor, the voice of the Canucks, at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. Sorry, I actually had to look at the clock because this is outside my routine. Nonetheless, lovely to be chatting with you all today. Before we get into the program and everything that we'll address today, Zadorov stuff, coaching change, fallout, Rick Tocchet's brief media blitz, I want to let you know that Canucks Talk is brought to you by our kind friends at Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. And of course, this show is always coming to you live, regardless of where the hosts are, from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, is powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? And as always, when it's a solo program, I like to implore you, our dear listeners, to contribute to the show by using the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you. In Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, visit them online at DunbarLumber.com. All right, so let's begin with the frou-frou of the day. Our Sportsnet colleague, Ian McIntyre, a 30-year pro reporting on this team since the early 90s, reported that amid coaching news the last couple of weeks, there has been significant traction in contract talks with unrestricted free agents Nikita Zadorov and Elias Lindholm. Maybe neither resigns, but it's possible the Canucks could keep both. That report, however, was decried as fake news by friend of the podcast, Dan Milstein, veteran agent of Gold Star, who represents Zadorov and has represented a number of Canucks clients in the very recent past, currently including Ilya Mikheyev, and a lot of other reporting. Post Media's Patrick Johnston, Donnie and Dolly's Rick Dhaliwal suggest that things have been quiet, at least on the Zadorov front. So, you know what we like to say on this program. You know how we like to read these types of circumstances. And this is how. Negotiations are never close until they're done. That's how negotiations work, right? Final offers, they get tense. You get down to brass tacks. Sometimes one final elbow gets thrown out in the public sphere. One by the team, one by the agent. Sometimes, just at the moment that you hear that things are bad in contract talks, that there's a significant chasm still to bridge, sometimes it's in those moments when deals get done. So, in general, Rick Dhaliwal's reporting on this, you know, we know Rick Dhaliwal's record, right? We know Rick Dhaliwal's information is excellent. We also know that Ian McIntyre is careful. We know that he's not throwing a phrase like significant traction out for no reason. And honestly, I don't know that you necessarily look at that and think that those two things don't square. I guess where the information becomes a little more complicated to unpack is all the reporting about it being quiet on the Zadorov front. And of course, the agent specifically suggesting that it's fake news to suggest that there's traction. We don't really know how this will play out. We'll have to wait and see. I would guess though that at the very least, McIntyre's reporting reflects perhaps a priority list for the hockey club itself. And this is interesting for a variety of reasons. The first is, in my view, the top priority should be Filip Hronek, and yet the timeline on Filip Hronek is where the club has more flexibility, right? You can go into the summer, and in fact, you probably should go into the summer with Hronek in terms of where those negotiations or discussions go, right? There's so many different leverage points that favor the player, that favor the team. You know, there's going to be a desire to avoid arbitration. There's going to be a desire, you know, to avoid appearing in Toronto in front of a magistrate or an arbitrator. But like, truly, there's going to be a desire to avoid that process. That desire can stimulate resolution and often does. You know, 22 of the 24 players that filed for arbitration last summer settled before it got there. So, you know, that's one that feels like a mid-July deal anyway. So even though it's the top priority, I don't think you read too much into, oh, well, the club is prioritizing Zadorov instead or anything like that, because it makes sense that they would. There's like a drop-dead date on Zadorov contracts talks. This club will lose their exclusive negotiating rights with him on July 1. At that point, he'll be free to the highest bidder, free to select the destination that offers him and his family the most. And we know how important term is going to be in determining that deal. So I think takeaway number one is, of the Canucks pending unrestricted free agents, does McIntyre's report reflect that the club has decided that Lindholm and Zadorov are their top priorities? That's my major question coming out of this, my major takeaway. You know, the tit for tat, the what's it all mean, the reading between the lines, I think that's all fair. Look, there's a lot of reporting suggesting that it's quiet. McIntyre's reporting suggesting something else, at least on the Zadorov file. You know, we'll see. But the preponderance of evidence suggests it's been quiet and that there's a fair bit of distance still to gap. And yet again, you know, I do think we need to take that medicine with the healthy dose of sugar that is a reminder of how this organization has relatively frequently done business. You remember the Brock Besser negotiation, that settlement, elbows thrown right before the deal gets done. You'll remember the pressure the organization put on Bruce Boudreau to decide on his mutual option ahead of the timeline that was called for in the contract and that both sides had been explicit about on locker room cleanout day. You'll remember that this club took Elias Pettersson aside before he agreed to his extension, right? And in following up on an Elliot Friedman report from a Saturday, literally a week prior to Elias Pettersson committing to Vancouver on an 8-year mega contract, had reported that the Canucks were exploring trade offers, and the organization told that to the player's face. And sometimes that heat stimulates a deal, right? So you can be far apart. You can have the principal saying you're far apart. And yet the thing about negotiations, right? The thing about negotiations across the board is they're never close until they're close. And progress can be made rapidly. One phone call. That's why you have the insider language that everyone uses to immensely and impressively and in extraordinary detail qualify. Things can change, but this is the best intel that I've got at the moment. I want to talk about the idea of extending Lindholm and Zadorov a little bit more philosophically and in a way that ties into what we were talking about yesterday about narrow paths versus, you know, wider ones, right? This club's been tracing a narrow path here under new management, and they've done it impressively well. They've gotten extraordinarily far this past season, looked to have made significant progress. A lot of bets, risky ones, panned out and didn't just pan out, but were home run cuts from Canucks management. And now you're approaching this summer with oodles of cap flexibility, but less than your full set of draft capital or draft chips, trade chips to play with in terms of draft capital. And, you know, not the fullest stable of prospects. Go read over at The Athletic today. We've got numbers 10 through 6 in our top 10 Canucks prospect rankings, and four of the five are undrafted, which isn't to say that they're not good prospects or players that Canucks fans should have hope for in terms of their ability to contribute down the line. It just, you know, speaks volumes about this club's overall approach, about the fact that management has, you know, expended a lot of draft capital, hasn't made their full allotment of picks, and has really prioritized, you know, filling in their prospect pipeline with unconventional bets, some of which have hit. All right, and some of which have hit impressively. But, you know, which does leave you a little bit out of step with league consensus and certainly with less ammunition to count on in terms of internal replacements for the bevy of unrestricted free agent players that the Canucks are losing. Now, regarding the narrow path and the broad path, The Canucks won this past season, in my opinion. Like, it wasn't just a narrow path that the club carved out in terms of team building, right? I think it reflected how the team played, right? We saw this team dominate offensive zone possession and really try and push the advantage that they had in that area, really try to turn the screws to opponents, not by looking to generate a million scoring chances or looking to make high-risk cross-seam creative plays to get goals, but instead by relying on perimeter shooting, getting body position, generating layered traffic in front of goaltenders' eyes, changing on the fly after withering persistent offensive zone shifts, fresh bodies, churn, and most importantly, churn and continue to play within a set of staples that caused this team to be comfortable. You know, going high low, putting the puck back behind the net, battling it out, retaining possession, doing it all over again, right? What this team didn't want was passes into the slot that were a little bit hopeful, that were a little bit creative. Not that the system stifles creativity. I want to be clear here either. But be sure, if you're making that shot, if you're making that pass, be sure. Make sure you don't hit the net. You don't want to miss far side low and have the puck rim off the glass and feed your opponent's rush attack, right? You definitely don't want to be getting picked off, high in the zone and or off of an entry where you're leaning and the other team can attack against you. I mean, that was the rush chances against issue that this Canucks team had in spades in the waning days of the Bruce Boudreau era. It's one of the main things that talk it cut out. And the thing about hockey is, when we talk about defense, we're often talking about like a defensive zone positioning, but this is a static dynamic game. Like, you are literally always defending and attacking at the same time. And the Canucks leveraged offensive zone time as a defensive weapon, right? They prioritized limiting their opponents ahead of generating themselves, right? Now, we saw in the playoffs how effective that can be. We saw how little space, how little oxygen, how little room to breathe the Nashville Predators had, right? In the second round against the Edmonton Oilers, we saw both the limitations of the Canucks' approach, but also the way that it can work to frustrate an opponent. The way that when Vancouver's forecheck was able to get on top of Oilers' defenders late in game one, early in game three, certainly throughout game five, the Canucks were able to establish and force McDavid to play in the defensive zone and actually control play a little bit with the pressure game down ice in combination with their conservative style their conservative approach in the offensive zone. And Lindholm and Zadorov are players that in some ways feed this, right? Now, Zadorov, I've talked about a lot because I find him so fascinating as a player, right? We're talking about a big-bodied, heavy-hitting, smash-mouth 6'6" defenseman who is, characteristically aggressive in terms of how he plays with the puck, right? It's not uncommon to see Zadorov lead a rush. It's not uncommon to see Zadorov look to take ice in the neutral zone and skate it himself. It's not unusual to see Zadorov streaking deep into the zone, even behind the net as a puck carrier below the blue line. Zadorov goes for it. And yet, despite that, and despite a relatively widespread sense around the league that, hey, you kind of want to let Zadorov play at least a little bit because eventually there'll be a mistake that you can capitalize off of. A, those mistakes never came in the playoffs. So any team waiting for it was sorely disappointed. And, the Oilers and the Predators certainly would have been if that was their read. But also, despite that, despite what it looks like, despite the occasional chaos that Zadorov brings and chaos that's welcome when he's at his best, his impact is mostly defensive. His impact is mostly on limiting opponents' chances, shots, right? Like, he's a quality defensive player who achieves quality defensive results both with his, long reach, significant size, physical assertiveness, physical imposingness, and also by his ability to help just do enough in transition to get the puck moving, feeding an offensive zone possession game, which is Vancouver's bread and butter. He is, in some ways, the template player of what you want from a Canucks defenseman if this team's going to continue to play a style, carve out a narrow path to winning hockey games, which they did so successfully this past year. Lindholm, for me, is kind of the same. You know, you look at Lindholm and you think about how he performed in this playoffs, and I think the defense is unquestionable. He wins draws. He took the highest rate of defensive zone draws among all Canucks forwards at 5-on-5, did the same on the penalty kill, crushed it in the circle game after game. You can see how heavy he plays away from the puck, the way he hounds forwards and defensemen, both puck carriers in the neutral zone, his strength on the wall, his ability to win battles. And he combines all of that with, you know, a real nose for the net down low. Right? This is a good a player who's really good at working in space, getting open, figuring out opportunities, finding quiet areas of the ice. And this is a player who can do damage at the net front, both as a playmaker, as a finisher, as a body, a screener, a guy trying to get those second stick opportunities, as Rick Tocchet likes to refer to them. Now, those players and retaining those players is a really effective way of doubling down on what makes this Canucks team who they were the last season. I think a lot of Canucks fans would be happy with that. A lot of Canucks fans loved last season. I do think, though, when you think about what you have to get to, where you have to be a team more in the mold of the Panthers and the Oilers, as opposed to, you know, a team that had a dream season fall short across a pair of Game 6 and Game 7s against Edmonton, where they managed just 32 total shots and scored 3 total goals, two of them in the final 8 minutes of Game 7 when that contest was already decided. The game-winning goal was already on the board for the Oilers. You know, now Tocchet sort of referred to it a little bit on his Halford and Brough hit today. He referred to the idea of rush offense being unsustainable, suggesting that he's not, and this is a quote, a riverboat gambler in terms of looking to generate off the rush. And this is where I think things get so fascinating, right? Because he's always right, right? Like, there's nothing about this that's wrong or nonsense. Like, Rick Tocchet knows what he's talking about. You don't need to hear that from me. And yet, you know, I do think there's a level of risk that this club is ultimately going to need to take on to begin to be the sort of team that generates frequently enough, right? To overcome elite defenses in the playoffs, to you know, have games where you're not getting 15, 16 shots on goal, unless it's a one-off. Not as a typical thing, but like, hey, it happened once to us over 15 games, like what happened to the Oilers in Game 6 against Dallas, as opposed to it being like every night you look up and the Canucks have 17 shots on net, but like 3 deflection goals, right? He's right that if this club is going to try and generate more off the rush, that's going to come with a cost the other way, because every time you don't score, every time you don't finish, you've left space open behind you. You can be attacked vertically, right? And that's what Tocchet doesn't want. This is not a team that wants to trade chances. This is a team that wants to suck the oxygen out of the game and rely on variance to get it done. And when I think about Zadorov and Lindholm and how they fit into that, you know, I do think you're looking at a pair of players that if you retain, especially at, you know, something like 11 to 12 million combined, which is probably what you're looking at, you still have space to bring back Hronek. You still probably have space to go mid-tier shopping for additional top six forward reinforcements. You'd be one of the best teams in terms of your center depth. You'd have a really strong left side of your defense core. I mean, if you're looking at returning Myers, Zadorov, and Hronek, you know, that's pretty good. You have to figure out third pair RD. You can do that on the fly. This club acquired Ethan Bear for a fifth round pick. Like, Noah Juulsen performed pretty well until the playoffs last season. Cole McWard's one of their more intriguing sort of prospects down on the farm. Played really well in the Calder Cup playoffs. I mean, there's paths to doing that. That's not a bad outcome by any means, but it's an outcome that doubles down on what made this team effective this year. And I think there's an opportunity, my view of it anyway, is there's an opportunity this offseason to try and level up, right? To try and do more than just be a high-end defensive team, right? That struggles to generate shots, to maybe become a more like three-dimensional team, a more well-rounded team, as opposed to, you know, a club that's going to be really reliant on special teams, goaltending, finishing efficiency, and defense, right? I do think ultimately you're going to want another gear, because in my opinion, in the contemporary NHL, there's like 10 teams that are good enough defensively to go deep. And what's going to separate the wheat from the chaff, what's going to separate the Panthers from the Rangers is that you get to these pointy ends of playoff series. And if you don't have the ability to generate chances, you look dead in the water. There's still ways to win too, right? Like you can still get a Barkley Gaudreau shooting streak. You can still get Stuart Skinner getting the yips for three games. Like there's still ways to advance. And if Demko's healthy for the Canucks, that's a game changer too. If they can get Demko healthy and combine this defensive form, their strength through the middle, a big physical defense, and what they can do at the top of the lineup, you know, if you can get Demko in there playing, you know, at his best on one of his dominant stretches, and you're able to get the power play, you know, cranked up just a little bit, you know, just looking a little more like it did in October and November, there's a path to this team going on deep runs, sustaining this success. But once again, it's a narrower path in my mind than one in which you seek out players that can, at sort of a higher caliber or a higher volume, right? Help you generate within Rick Tocchet's system, permitting you to play the same way while generating more and higher quality looks, the way, you know, Jake Guentzel and Kuznetsov did for Carolina after their acquisition at the trade deadline, even if Carolina ultimately fell short, you know, with a series of one goal losses to the New York Rangers in the second round. That to me is like the opportunity that exists this offseason. It's an opportunity to go out there and try and push this club's ceiling a little bit higher, to try and widen the path forward, the path that could result in, you know, a durable contending team with a real shot. Doubling down on it, in my view, while it makes sense and while I think it would help this team, you know, sustain some of their success, I also think it would limit them a little bit. I also think if you spend that much on just returning Zadorov and Lindholm, you know, a couple players who make excellent defensive impact, but who are pretty reliant on that variance game to generate offense, I worry that it caps the Canucks out as like, you know, almost like a Kings level, right? Or like a Carolina level team, as opposed to shooting for something a little bit more contemporary, a little bit more like those teams that seem to be having success come playoff time year after year. You know, it's not necessarily the Lou Lamoriello Devils anymore, right? It's the Avalanche. It's the attacking off the rush at all moments, Vegas Golden Knights. It's the, you know, the Panthers and the Oilers, high octane offensive teams that seem to be getting deep into the postseason year after year these days. Not that the Canucks should copy anyone else, right? These are pendulums that swing. You can definitely still win with defense, elite goaltending, a killer power play, and on in the NHL, playing the way Rick Tocchet wants to play. I believe in it. But I do think grafting more high-end skill into the lineup as opposed to doubling down on what worked this year just because it worked this year, it would certainly be my preference in terms of the path that the Canucks traced through this offseason. We will see, though, with conflicting reports out there from Vancouver media, with the agents getting involved, about the status of contract talks and whether or not there is significant traction in contract talks with Elias Lindholm and Nikita Zadorov, a prospect which Zadorov's agent, Dan Milstein, referred to earlier today as fake news. All right, we'll be back with Brendan Batchelor on the other side. You're listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. We're back. It's Canucks Talk, brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. Of course, we're coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? And of course, you can use the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line to chat with Batch and I for the next half hour. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver. Visit them online at dunbarlumber.com. All right, let's bring in Brendan Batchelor and get his reaction to the contested news of the day. First of all, Batch, how are you doing?
Hello, Thomas, my old friend. I've come to talk again. How you doing, buddy?
I can't believe how much discussion that got and how many people refused to accept the truth, the self-evident truth, right? that while Paul Simon was the better of the two, they did their most iconic work together, which was the whole point of the analogy.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you when you phrase it that way. But the way I put this when I talked about it with Bick and Jamie last week when you were off is that while they did their best work together, Paul Simon was still totally fine without Art Garfunkel. And if the Canucks chose to move away from Philip Hronek and, you know, prioritize the cap space they would have to allocate to him to other areas of the roster where you could argue they have a greater need, like their top six forward group, then, you know, I think Quinn Hughes would be fine with whoever they'd pair him with. And that is a luxury that they have in terms of some of the tough decisions they're going to have to make with who stays and who goes this offseason.
Yeah. Okay. So let's start here, because I do disagree with you, and I love disagreeing with my good friends and colleagues on air. So we're seeing right now, with what Edmonton does when Bouchard and Ekholm are on the ice, like when you have a pair that helps create this wild environment, like Bouchard's been on the ice for 25 goals and 10 against, right? It's like 2-1, 2.5-1 that they're generating in those minutes at the top end of their lineup. It makes you a nightmare. Like, you're a nightmare to try and play against. And obviously the Canucks don't have McDavid to put, you know, an atomic core into that particular engine, but with Hronek and Hughes on the ice, and especially when Miller was on with them, although Pettersson, it worked for Pettersson too earlier in the year, like that's what the Canucks were doing. Two shots, two goals, two shot attempts for every one they surrendered. It's a huge reason why they were able to do it. And while Hughes would be totally fine without Hronek, he's still going to be one of the best defensemen on the planet. You know, just like Bouchard would be totally fine without Ekholm, just like Heiskanen would be totally fine without Harley, just like Makar would be totally fine without Taves, that extra 5%, like, man, it makes such a huge difference, especially with how good all of these teams are at the top of the lineup.
I agree that it does. But at the same time, when you compare the Oilers and you talk about the drivers they have at the top of their lineup, the Canucks have some drivers at the top of their lineup, but I think we all agree they don't have enough. And that's why we're talking about the need for top six additions. And so, you know, if you can thread the needle where you bring Philip Hronek back, and yes, this is going to be an inflated number, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see if they do extend him and decide to keep him, what that number comes in at. And then, of course, there's also the conversation, which is a sidebar, about if they don't think they can afford him, then you also have to get, you know, fair trade value for him. And that's not necessarily something that's guaranteed either. So it's not like, you know, moving on from a pending UFA, there are a lot more complicating factors. If they could thread the needle where they can bring Hronek back and have that elite pairing while also being able to go out and acquire or sign a top six play driver that gives them that extra bit of edge, then I agree with your point. But my argument is that in a scenario where you still need those guys at the top of your lineup up front, having a guy like Hronek as a partner for Hughes is a luxury more than it is a necessity. The necessity is play driving up front. The necessity is having guys that can help you drive play more effectively and produce more effectively up your lineup. And, you know, absolutely agreed about Ekholm and Bouchard, but the Oilers have McDavid and Draisaitl. The Canucks don't have that. They do have guys that can drive play. They do have guys that can produce, but we all know that they're one or arguably even two top six forwards short of where they'd like to be. So for my money looking at this situation, if they can make it all work, right? If Hirona can come back and they can add the pieces they need to their top six, then that's fine by me. That works. But in a world where they're working with only so much cap space and they've got decisions to make on other guys, if you could find a player at half the money of Hironic that gives you up until that extra 5%, as you alluded to it, then that might be the better way to move forward if it means that you can add more of that play-driving ability up front in the top six.
Yeah, I mean, I think, though, if the Canucks had $11 million in cap space, I would be all aboard with your plan. Mm-hmm. I'd be like, that money needs to be allocated differently. But they have 25, you know, they have mid-20s millions of dollars. So you can do Hironic. You can still do a big swing, and you can still keep a priority free agent or two, maybe not the top-end one in Elias Lindholm, assuming he's going to cost 7+, but you can probably keep a couple more of your pending free agents. And to me, that's like the optimal way through, in part because I kind of reject the separation of drivers up front versus drivers on the back end. Like, I just think you need a little bit more in terms of what you can do at the top end of your lineup. Like, I think you need to be able to create more control and more scoring chances fundamentally, because this team actually does control play pretty well 5-on-5. It's just that they don't generate enough looks so that when a goaltender's not playing poorly, like, do you have answers offensively? That's where I think the top of the lineup is what they have to be mindful of here. And for me, Hironic's part of that equation. Like, what Hironic does with Hughes is part of that. I think they can do, I think they can do multiple things. For me, the decision is not Hironic versus a top six forward. It's Hironic ahead of most of the pending UFAs plus a top six forward. You know, like, to me, that's the right decision here.
Yeah, and I guess the question then comes down to how much is too much, and what can we realistically expect that number to look like? What does a Hironic contract look like? If they were to give him max term, does that allow them to bring the AAV down and make that more palatable? Like, that is where the conversation shifts to me, because I think, you know, principally we agree about Hironic's value to the team. To me, it's just about whether you want to pay a premium for that when you're going to need to spend premium dollars on other areas of the roster. And again, they do have a lot of cap space this year. They do have opportunity, but they really need to strike while the iron's hot right now. And, you know, with a guy like Hironic, how would you characterize him, I guess, is where I would go from here then. Is he complementary, or is he like a key play driver himself? Like, when we talk about the core of this team, I don't think of Filip Hironic as a core player, but I'm pretty stingy with my core group. Like, have you seen enough from him that you would consider him a core player on this team?
I mean, the analogy that I would throw out there is, and I don't want to say he's as important or as good, but the analogy that I'd throw out there is like Zach Hyman. Like, would you call Zach Hyman a core part of the Oilers?
No, I'd call him like the next tier below that, like the top
right.
level of complementary player.
He's a supporting piece. He's a supporting piece, but he's a supporting piece at the top of the lineup, right? And for me, that's different. It's like Alex Burrows, right? Alex Burrows would be an analogy in from the Canucks past, where it's like he's not the guy who drives their top line, but he complements it in such a way that it's better with him there, right?
Yeah.
And for me, that's like Hyman and Edmonton. Like, Hyman right now is 33-1 to win the Conn Smythe in the Stanley Cup final here. He's also 4 goals away from having scored more goals than anyone has ever done in a playoff run. It's like, how do you square that? It's, well, we just all know, you know, that it's 97 driving the bus, right? Like, we all know that Hyman might be the perfect guy to capitalize off of all of what McDavid does, you know, to give him an extra gear in terms of just another guy who can match his fitness level on retrievals. And, you know, but we also know how to separate primary responsibility out. And so with Hironic, I look at it similarly. Like, and by the way, this is a question the Maple Leafs had to ask themselves. And they managed to replace Hyman for $900K for 2 years for Michael Bunting, who had, you know, 110 points over two subsequent seasons. Like, he literally filled in 90% of what Hyman for 5.5 did with no termed commitment at, you know, under $1 million per year. So, like, they even successfully replaced the guy, and yet I think if you asked most fans in Toronto today, would you rather have Hyman or have had those two seasons with Bunting, no one would hesitate. Like, no one would hesitate. That extra 5 or 10% matters so much to me. So that's how I'd view him. I'd view him as you found this guy. You paid through the nose, frankly, to acquire him. And one of the reasons why, when I was scrutinizing the deal last year, I suggested it wasn't a good one was that, you know, I thought it had limited upside. I thought if it was a deal that worked, that it would be a deal where the Canucks, you know, would have to pay him so much as a result of their bet working that it would, you know, sort of mitigate the long-term value of spending draft assets the way they did. That's come to pass, but there's no denying, like, to the 99th percentile, Hronek has exceeded all reasonable expectations here, in part because of his perfect fit with Hughes.
Yeah, absolutely he has. And again, I circle back to the conversation about, like, where does that dollar amount come in? How painful is that contract at the end of the day? And what sort of, like, that, the thing that Hronek has working for him is that he's young. So you could sign him to a max term deal. And while, you know, you may not want to sign a guy through what, 34, I think he would be by the end of an 8-year extension, you know, that might be the best way for both parties to go about this, because you can bring the AAV down a little bit. He can get his big payday. He can get some, you know, security that he, you know, for the most part knows where he's going to play for most of the next decade. And, you know, that helps you set up Hughes in the longer term with a partner, assuming that they remain partners, because we did hear Patrick Alvin allude to the fact that they might need Hronek to play on his own pairing. And that's what I wonder is, organizationally, Drancer, they've talked about, you know, he may need to drive his own pairing. He may need to play apart from Quinn Hughes. How much does that reduce or limit the value of bringing a guy like Hronek back, if the plan may not necessarily be to play him with Hughes going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think that's a good plan. You know, like, I don't think it's a reason to not bring him back or to be mindful of cost. I think you found this perfect fit. I think you roll with that perfect fit and focus on acquiring another top pair defenseman to drive your second pair. You know, for me, I don't care if Hronek drives his own pair or not. What I want is him to play 200 minutes and generate a massive goal differential with Quinn Hughes. Like, yeah. I want more of that. And that's what I think they should pay for. I don't think they should pay for a second pair right D who can drive a second pair. I think they should pay for a guy who, in combination with Hughes, gave them a top five defense pair in the league this season, without question, like, arguably top two or three.
Yeah, no, they were, like, you're not going to hear any argument from me about how good they were together, but I think that has to be part of the calculation here when you're talking about probably overpaying a guy, let's be honest, because, you know, his numbers were inflated by being able to play with Quinn Hughes all year long. And that's not to take anything away from him as a player, because I think he's a very good defenseman, but I think even he, in a private, honest moment, would admit that getting to play with Quinn Hughes benefited his game, benefited his production, but he playing with Hughes also benefited Hughes' production and allowed him to reach a higher ceiling where he's likely to win the Norris Trophy this year. But that's one of the reservations I have as well, is I agree with you. Like, if they are bringing him back, it probably should be to just be Quinn Hughes' running mate. But the fact that we've heard noises out of the organization about he needs to drive his own pair, he needs to play away from him, to me, makes it that much more risky to likely overpay a guy if you're not going to use him in the spot that has allowed him to have the most success.
Yeah, I mean, it might also just be a preview of what they'll present at arbitration.
Yeah, that's true.
But here's the thing. How do you value anybody then? Like, Hughes warps the gravity of the game so much. You know what I mean? Like, there's the Canucks got outshot with JT Miller on the ice when Quinn Hughes wasn't with him, right? The Canucks got outshot with Elias Pettersson on the ice when Quinn Hughes wasn't with him. right? I mean, that's true for like all of Vancouver's main drivers except Garland.
We can't hold it against them that they have a Norris Trophy winner on their team, right? Like that's talk about, you don't apologize for good goaltending. You don't apologize for Quinn Hughes.
Heck no. You just enjoy it. And if you happen to absolutely nail the acquisition of the perfect partner to him, and because you nailed it to such an extent, you've given that player enough leverage that he's going to cost you $1 million premium per year AAV. It's like that to me is the good problem. You know, like those are the problems that you can manage because the bet you placed hit so heavily that now you have to pay a premium to keep the guy. Like to me, that's fine. That's the money you want to pay to a 26-year-old top pair right-handed defenseman who has proven to fit. You know, like for me, there's no comparison between Hronek and the other pending free agents here in terms of what matters. You know, like first line center, second line center, first pair left D, first pair right D. Those are the positions I think you can live with overpaying guys, especially if they're as young as Hronek is.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me too. I guess it's all about opportunity cost. It's right. It's I know you already made the point that they've got more cap space, but it's if they could bring in I don't know who's a guy they could sign as a UFA this year that could replace Hronek if they tried to move on. Like, is it Sean Walker out of Philly? Is that a guy that? So
sure, like, but you're saving $2 million to go from Hronek to Sean Walker or whatever. Like.
Yeah, so I guess what could you do with that $2 million? And if what you could do with that $2 million outweighs what Hronek brings, then you have to consider it. But that's all hypothetical at this point. So we'll have to see how the offseason plays out, and then we can judge what their decision is with Hronek and with many others in terms of, you know, could they have done something else if they didn't bring him back? Or conversely, if they don't bring him back, what do they do with the added flexibility, and how do they move forward? And I think another thing we have to sort of weigh in this conversation that hasn't been talked about enough is that Quinn Hughes really likes playing with Filip Hronek. And, you know, you want to keep your guys happy. You want to keep guys feeling good. And not to say that you would make all of your organizational decisions based on what one guy wants, but Hughes just had a career year playing with Hronek. He likes playing with him. He wants to play with him. And that ultimately could be a pretty big factor in this too.
Before we go, Batch, we have about 6-7 minutes left. I just wanted to ask you about Yogi Shevkovsky, promoted from skills coach to assistant coach for the Canucks. Yogi's a guy you've known for a while. You were the voice of the Giants while Yogi was a skills coach there before you were the voice of the Canucks, where Yogi has been a skills coach until his promotion this week. Just want to get your thoughts on Yogi as a person, what you can tell our listeners about what you know of the man, and what your thoughts were on him getting this opportunity.
I was so happy for him. He is an absolutely great guy and a really good influence around a team, I would say. And like my experience is more seeing him around like teenage hockey players in the WHL. But like, I think one thing that we don't talk about enough is that this guy was a really good player in his own right. He was a first round pick who had some injuries and that kind of shortened his career, but he was a very good player. And so he's a guy that players respect because they can see the skill level that he has. So when you can tell that your skills coach was an incredibly skilled player, you're more likely to listen to him and learn from him. And that's a big part of the reason why I think the Canucks coaching staff in general has had a lot of success, is because what are you going to do? Not go into the corners and fight for a battle when Rick Tocchet tells you to do it? Are you going to not block a shot when Adam Foote tells you to do it? Are you not going to implement some sort of skill element into your game if Daniel or Henrik Sedin or if Yogi Shevkovsky tell you to do it? No, because players respect guys that have been there and have done it. And Yogi is that guy. On top of the fact that he's one of the nicest people you'll meet, I, you know, even ran into him at the rink earlier this year. And like, you know, we worked with the Giants together like nearly a decade ago, but he still stopped and had a long conversation asking how I was doing, asking how my kids were doing. Like, he's that kind of person. And then on top of that, he's a relentlessly hard worker who is really committed. If you give him an opportunity, if you give him a task, he's going to do that job and do it to the best of his ability. And I think we heard Rick Tocchet talk about that yesterday in terms of how much Yogi's work ethic has impressed the coaching staff and the brain trust in Vancouver. So this is a guy that has fully earned this opportunity by being someone that players like to be around, being someone that players can learn from, and being a tirelessly hard worker at that as well. So couldn't be happier. I thought it was a tremendous decision for them, and I think it's going to, you know, reap benefits for them for years to come, putting him in an elevated role and giving him more opportunity to have an impact with this roster and with some of their young players that need to continue to learn and grow as they're, you know, in a contention window right now.
And one last one for you. It's a day of contested reports about Zadorov and Lindholm and whether there's significant traction or things are quiet. You know, charges of fake news being thrown around by player agents and on and on. When you encounter moments where there's a lot of information out there and presumably a fair bit of spin, how do you digest it? What's your advice to Canucks fans on how to work through the approaching NHL silly season?
I'm thankful that I'm the play-by-play guy in situations like this because it's not my job to figure out what's true and what's not. So I'm like most of the fans sitting back here, just taking it all in, you know, seeing where things play out. And oftentimes in situations like this, you know, in this case, it comes down to, you know, one person saying one thing and another person saying another thing. But oftentimes this is spin, right? This is, you know, a player and the agent wanting to get their side of the story out and a team and an organization wanting to get their side of the story out. So, you know, oftentimes my approach when trying to weed through information like this is to say that neither side is probably the 100% truth and that the reality is somewhere in the middle. But I'm thankful that it's not my job to break these stories or provide endless analysis of things like this, because I have no idea in terms of who you can take at their word, who you can't, and who may have been fed good information, who may have been fed bad information. Like, this is the part of the business that I'm not best suited for. So I'm just going to sit back, put my feet up, and wait until we have actual news, and then I can talk about that.
Fair enough. Any recipes for making popcorn?
Recipes for making popcorn.
Yeah, no, like I'm not to eat while enjoying the show.
Yeah, I see. Putting my feet up, having popcorn. I'm not a big popcorn guy. Actually, I'll have it when I go to the movies.
Really?
But I don't like make it at home casually. So, like, I'm pretty standard. Like, give me a good buttered popcorn with enough salt that there's some good flavor to it. But I'm not high maintenance when it comes to my popcorn.
Wow, that's rare for a rink rat batch. Usually eating it out of garbage bags.
I was going to say,
hey,
you have to be willing to.
Thanks so much for taking the time to join us today, and
rat.
Thanks for the debate on the Philip Hronek situation.
Sounds good. Thanks for your answer. Have a good one.
And that's going to do it for our special 1 hour edition of Canucks Talk this afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow. Josh Elliott Wolf co-hosting with me in our usual time slot. Thanks for listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.